From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The film production landscape in North Carolina in this first quarter of 2019 consists of Swamp Thing and Uncle Frank, which is in pre-production. Words on Bathroom Walls has wrapped, and the pilot Reprisal is on the way. According to the North Carolina Film Commission, 11 productions came to the state last year. Compare that to 23 in 2012, the year of Iron Man 3, and 35 productions the following year, in 2013. There's a community of film professionals in the Wilmington area who have, for decades, been part of the draw, the infrastructure, for producers, along with the facilities at EUE Screen Gems. But traffic took a nosedive after the state legislature killed the tax rebate form of the film incentive in 2014. Since then, legislators have been building up the grant money available to film and TV producers and have passed a law that adds $31 million to the pot each year with no sunset. Production in North Carolina is growing, but it's not near the volume of the early teens. Today, we're going to meet two career film professionals, but not the kind we often meet when we talk about film. They're not actors or screenwriters or directors first, but they are as critical to the end product. Tom Priestley is a director of photography, now retired, and while the list of films he's worked on would take the rest of the show to get through, here are some highlights. The Thomas Crown Affair, Demolition Man, Die Hard with a Vengeance, I Know What You Did Last Summer. Before working as DP, he was a camera operator on dozens of films, including Midnight Cowboy, The French Connection, The Exorcist, Network, Annie Hall, Saturday Night Fever, Hair, Kramer versus Kramer, Sophie's Choice, it goes on. Tom Priestley, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Joseph D'Alessandro is a camera operator. He's worked in film since 1982, and some of his more notable films include Bull Durham, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Prince of Tides, Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, Nell, starring Jodie Foster, Tammy, starring Melissa McCarthy, and most recently, The Hate U Give. TV series include The Golden Years, American Gothic, One Tree Hill, and Dawson's Creek. Joe D'Alessandro, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel.
And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. Have you always wanted to know what a film set is like through the eyes of a crew member? You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Tom Priestley, The Thomas Crown Affair was a 1999 remake with Rene Russo and Pierce Brosnan. It was a remake of the 1968 film starring Faye Dunaway and Steve McQueen. Which elements of that original did you want to make sure that you kept, and how did you want to update it? Why did people want to do this again?
Well, originally, I didn't want to copy the old film. I wanted to be new and exciting. And I think it's a classic example of the sequel being better than the original film. I think the production value is bigger. I think the photography is terrific. The direction is terrific. The actors were great. And the only element we really kept was Faye Dunaway. She did a cameo appearance one day in the studio, did a couple of scenes with Pierce Brosnan, and that was it. I think everyone on the film really wanted to make a different film. They didn't want to be stereotyped or categorized. So we did it the old-fashioned way.
So as director of photography on that film, do you go in thinking it needs to have a certain kind of look? Or how do you approach that?
Well, there's a number of things that dictate the look of the film. The location, of course, the actors, the director's vision, and my vision. What I personally try to do is make the actors look as good as I possibly can. I know it sounds a little corny, but they're in this profession to look good, and then I think that, you know, their careers rise and fall on, you know, how they appear on screen. So I try to do that to especially the women. But the picture itself kind of evolved as the locations came up, and I had discussions with the director. Well, we always talked about camera angles, camera movement, and the general overall look of the film.
And when you think about that film, is there a particular scene where you feel like you came up with a really innovative way of shooting it, or you solved a problem that no one could figure out how to solve?
Well, I think the scene where they're in the security room, where they have the images of the infrared images on the screen, I added a lot of blue light that wasn't existing at the time to give it some rich feel to it, because it was mostly all black and white. I used a faster film to get a much larger f-stop so that we'd have more depth of field, because the images on the screen were very faint, and it was a problem, and I hadn't seen them before we went in there, so it was kind of an immediate decision. But other than that, I think that, and also the main hall of the museum, where they had the skylight.
And this is the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
Yes, which we built on the stage and cut a hole in the roof and put a skylight in so they could get the helicopter blades and look up and see the helicopter. But that, too, was a big challenge. I couldn't put sunlight on the paintings. You know, you only could put so much light on certain things. So, but other than that, it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Joe D'Alessandro. It's usually the actors and the well-known Hollywood directors who do the promotional film tours and become known for a particular piece of work. But can you describe the role of the camera operator and how that actually affects the artistic outcome of a film?
Good question. I think that depends on the particular film and the particular way of working with the director and director of photography. On certain projects, and maybe TV, it's a little more maybe straightforward in that a certain amount of work has to get done, and there's a certain kind of predetermined aesthetic that has to happen. Because in many ways, television is more of a producer's medium than a director's medium.
And why do you say that?
Well, because directors come and go. You know, if there's a series with, 10 or 15 episodes, there are numerous directors. So they absolutely bring a particular vision and an idea, but it's very much within, the prescribed recipe or the standards of that particular show. So in some ways, when you're working in television, it's a little more defined. And then also the pace of work, I think, dictates that, because you're doing a lot more page count. So in some ways, the relationship between the director, director of photography, and the operator is much more defined. You know, you do a more typical kind of coverage. Whereas I think in features, sometimes the so-called British system, which I think I would defer to Tom on that, and he could talk more about that because he also had a brilliant career as an operator.
When I worked in New York, we had the pleasure of having a lot of foreign cinematographers come and work there. And their system is such that the operator, camera operator, and the director basically set up the camera, set up all the angles with the director of photography only lights. And occasionally he'll put his opinion in once in a while, but mostly the operator has a lot more creative freedom. And that was, I think, paramount to my career. I mean, I had so much fun working with these directors, terrific directors, and you learn so much, and you have more time
than you would on
a TV show, which is really fast-paced.
So in that film, The Thomas Crown Affair, which you will be talking about on March 28th at the Cameron Art Museum, and we'll talk more about that later in the discussion, but that film is rated R, and it has a few sex scenes featuring Rene Russo and Pierce Brosnan. Shooting of sex scenes, love scenes, has changed quite a bit since this film was shot in 1998 or 99. But can you talk about how you, as the director of photography, approach those scenes?
Well, as I spoke to you before, I mean, most sex scenes are complicated, and most of the actors feel uncomfortable. So they try to make it as easy for them as possible. They're always asking you to take light off them. Don't let me look fat. Don't do this. Don't do that. It's common. But the thing that I try to do is make them happy, really, because it's hard enough to act, and when you're naked, it's a little more difficult.
In some of the scenes, there were body doubles.
That's correct.
And why were some scenes body doubles and some scenes Mostly Rene Russo just was naked or topless. Well,
the obvious reason is the angles and the cuts were wide enough that you couldn't tell whether it was Rene or Pierce in the shot. And this way, they didn't have to get totally naked. I think Rene wore an undergarment and was just topless in the two scenes she was in. And she felt comfortable with that. And the crew was very comfortable with that. No one said anything, so it was okay. The doubles are just to facilitate the scene itself without having the actors do it.
And so when you bring the body doubles in, is there less concern on the set about the privacy of those actors because that's what they do? I mean, there are pretty strong regulations around who's allowed on the set during a scene like that, right?
The minimal amount of people are allowed on the set. It may be 3 or 4 people, and that's all. I mean, everybody respects their privacy, and they understand what's going on, and it's done very professionally.
Have you ever been shooting a love scene when the actors forgot about the cameras and simulation, and you just kept rolling? Yes, this is public radio. Yeah.
Yes, I have. At least I thought it was happening, but I didn't know for sure. But
what was the film?
Let me think now. Doesn't come to mind.
And maybe it'll come to you during the break. And if you think of it, let us know that. You're listening to Coastline. We're learning about film production through the eyes of a crew member. Director of photography Tom Priestley and camera operator Joe D'Alessandro are with us on this Thursday, and they're answering your questions. When we return from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It's typically actors and directors that show up in public forums to talk about their films, but today we're meeting two people who've spent their careers as key members of the crew. Tom Priestley served as director of photography on films such as The Thomas Crown Affair, Demolition Man, and Die Hard with a Vengeance. Joe D'Alessandro is a camera operator who's worked on the TV series One Tree Hill and Dawson's Creek, as well as feature films The Hate U Give, Tammy, Bull Durham, Prince of Tides. You can weigh in on this Thursday or ask your own question by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. When we think of the contributions of crew members versus those folks that are in front of the camera, we hear sometimes that the actors, for instance, will get outsized influence on the set in terms of being able to control maybe who keeps their job and who doesn't. Is that something that has changed over time? For instance, an actor seeing one of the crew members on the set, maybe not liking the way they look, or, you know, something that you as a professional would consider kind of petty, and the actor is able to dismiss them or replace them. Tom Priestley?
In my experience, I've never seen that happen on a set. It may have on other films, but not on my films. And most of the people are very professional, and if there seems to be any conflict at all, we'll just move the person out and put them in a different position.
So you haven't actually seen a crew member lose their job.
No.
Joe D'Alessandro?
You know, I don't know that I've seen it per se, but I have been on a film where there was that. It did happen, and I won't get specific, but unfortunately it does happen. I think it's the rare exception, and on balance, everyone is, it's a real community, and most sets are real positive, and there's a real collaborative spirit. So, but there has been occasion where certain performers have that kind of influence.
So a reasonable assumption would be, as you know, working in cinematography, this is your jam and you love this work. Is there ever a time that you feel your contributions to the film aren't really understood by the general public, Tom Priestley?
Well, I think when you come onto a film set, it seems very chaotic and undisciplined, but in reality, it's very efficient and well-planned. The crews are very professional. The actors know their lines. Everybody knows their job. So there isn't enough time to do a lot of things you want to do. But I always try to pick the best spot to try to enhance a scene or in general just to make the film a little bit better.
And you've said that time is money. Time is always your enemy. Tell us about that. How does it work? You're always...
Well, my example is I don't even wear a watch when I'm working on the set, because if you keep looking at your watch, you're going to have a heart attack. I mean, you try to get 55% of the work done in the first 6 hours and 45% of the work done in the last, because people get tired and things go a little slower. And that's kind of your barometer. Now, things may not go that well, but that's kind of the recipe for finishing. But it's always tight. It's very tight, and at some point you're going to have to sacrifice a little bit.
And planning is a huge part of that. So as director of photography, do you set up shot lists before you even start?
Well, based on the film, on the location scouted, and the script, I will sit down with the director, and we will take each scene as we see it in the location we plan to shoot it in, and we'll lay out a shot list so that when you show up on the set and you give these shot lists out to the people who need them, the crew responds, and everyone has a very general good idea of what you're going to do. Now, sometimes it may change when the actors get involved, but most times it holds pretty much the form. So we may do a shot list that might be 900,000 shots for a movie, and we try to get all the work we can. It's kind of like an A list and a B list. The A list is you have to have, and the B list is the wish list you hope you can get.
Have you ever worked on a production in which the producer just wanted to make sure that you got all of your A and B list shots and they didn't give you a time frame or a deadline? Or does that not exist?
No.
Okay, well, let's look at The Exorcist, because that was shot in the 70s when computer-generated imagery didn't exist. We just didn't have access to the special effects that exist now. And yet there are so many scenes in that film that must have been very difficult to shoot. There's one in which the room is very cold. How did you shoot that so that the breath was visible?
They decided to refrigerate the entire studio. They brought in extra equipment. And the thought was that while the set was being refrigerated, we would light the set and get set up. So once they reached the point where you could see the breath, they'd bring the actors in and shoot the scene. However, it was so noisy, we couldn't work in there while they were refrigerating the set. So in the morning, we'd come in, the director and the cameraman and the crew, we'd set up the shot we wanted to do. They'd start refrigerating the set. We waited maybe 2 or 3 hours, went back in, lit the thing, brought the actors in and shot it, and started the process all over again. So it took forever. I worked on The Exorcist for 9 months.
Wow.
Wow. And what would, for a film like that, what would a typical shoot time be?
55 days,
yeah,
the most.
And so how long before, once you have to turn off the refrigeration units, the lights are on, people are moving around, how long before the set warms up again?
Maybe 40 minutes, an hour at the most.
So you have to get it really fast.
Yes. Everybody's watching a thermometer.
Yeah. And you were working with a child actor, which adds, yes, another level of complexity.
And how is that complex in the 70s, having a child actor as the star?
Well, there's certain restrictions on how many hours they can be on the set. They have to have some schooling and other parameters. So we had to plan our day. The days were long, but the shooting schedule just didn't fit the practicality of what was going on. We may only get 2 or 3 shots a day. And the sequence where her body levitates off the bed, she had a body plate underneath her and tied to 4 steel cables going up in the ceiling. We had to set the camera, we couldn't move it, and then we had to hand paint the wires to match the background so you wouldn't see the wires. And then Cameron had to light it so he wouldn't backlight the wires. So I think that day we did one shot. It took a whole day to do.
You're listening to Coastline, The Exorcist, Bull Durham, Chorus Line, Die Hard with a Vengeance, The Thomas Crown Affair. That's a smattering of the productions my two guests today have worked on as critical members of the production team. With us today, Tom Priestley, director of photography, and Joe D'Alessandro, camera operator. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also give us a call during the live discussion at 910-343-1138. Joe, you told our producer that HB2, colloquially known as the bathroom bill, mm-hmm. actually had a negative impact on film productions coming to the state. Do you think that that's still having an effect?
Well, I think at some level. I couldn't speak to it specifically, but clearly it for certain productions that are here, it is not having an effect.
What did you hear in the industry? What were folks in the industry saying about it?
Well, I think there was, they didn't feel they went far enough. They did revise it.
Right.
And then certain industry leaders felt they didn't go far enough. It still was considered discriminatory, and that kept certain production companies, studios from coming. So they
have
still want more.
Have you heard that topic come up recently?
I haven't, but I'm not in that orbit particularly. You know, it's not really, you know, my part of the business, but so I can't speak to it specifically. But apparently it's starting to be overcome at some level. And, you know, the siege is over, I would like to say. Hopefully.
Tom Priestley, when did you move to Wilmington, and why did you choose to relocate here?
Well, it was something called an earthquake. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. And my wife said, when the earth moves, we move. So I had worked in Wilmington a number of years and just totally loved it, fell in love with the place. I was going to retire here, and I just took an early retirement, so to speak. I moved here in 1995. I've been here ever since. Love the area, and the people here are fantastic. The crews and everyone else, it's a wonderful place to live.
You continued to work after you moved here?
Oh, yes, but I would commute to Los Angeles or New York or shoot some films maybe in Chicago or Miami, depending on what was going on. But, you know, I lived here all the time. I just commuted.
What are some of the films that you worked on during that period when you were actually based in Wilmington?
The two I'm very proud of, it's called Barbershop 1 and 2. I did in Chicago. Of course, Thomas Crown Affair. That was... I think the two main films that I did, I like Chicago as well, a great place to shoot, good people, and the hardest part about shooting Barbershop was getting the actors to the set.
Why is that?
We had so many actors, and every scene had 10 or 12 actors, you know, one person would be on the phone, one person would be, that's the hardest part. I mean, besides shooting two cameras, six mirrors, I mean, it was tough.
When you have a complicated shot like that, where mirrors are in the shot, or in the Thomas Crown Affair, for instance, in the early part of the film, there's a scene when Pierce Brosnan is standing in his office and he's looking out over Manhattan, and there's a reflection of him in the glass. Do you ever get into post and realize, oh, crap, there's the crew, or, you know, there's some mistake in the way you shot it?
That's why you hire a good operator. He's supposed to take care of those things. Now, most of them, plus you have people watching the video, so those kind of mistakes don't happen as much as they used to.
Yeah, there is a saying that a good operator is very much responsible for what's in the frame and as much about what they keep out of the frame. Because there's always, we call them bogeys or things that are just on the edge of frame. So.
Right, like a mic dropping into the top of the frame.
Mic stands, lights, yeah.
Reflections are a cameraman's nightmare, a camera operator's nightmare, because a lot of times, looking through the camera, you don't see what the human eye sees, and it can get you in a lot of trouble. So you overcompensate, make sure everyone is clear, because otherwise they can't use the shot.
And I realize that, you know, this is a very, crew members are a very tight-knit group, and a very professional group, and nobody's going to badmouth anybody else, and I'm not looking for that. But are there examples of maybe films that you've worked on where there are mistakes in the shot? Joe, you're looking at me like you're so worried.
But, she found out.
But an example of something where you look back and you go, oh, yeah, that's there. Yeah. I mean, we've all seen, you know.
I did a picture once in it was a Tyler Perry film. And he was in the shot, and I was the operator. And because he was also directing the movie, he had this handheld monitor. And he was looking at it during what they call last looks, is where the makeup and hair people come in and do their last touches. So they were surrounding him. He was looking. And then he just placed it, like, on a table behind him. And then we were actually already rolling. So as soon as the people stepped out, he called action, and we rolled, and I didn't catch it. And it's in the shot. It's in the movie. But you wouldn't know what it was unless you looked for it. But so now everyone's going to know.
So you know, but most people wouldn't identify that.
Right. No. So that does happen on occasion. Have you had that experience at all, Tom?
Mostly with the microphone.
Yeah.
Because sound men always tell their boom operators, you know, lower the mic, lower the mic, lower the mic. And sometimes it could be masked by the background and you don't see it until it's on the screen and then you realize it's in the picture. They can blow up the image a little bit, but you get embarrassed.
And more than the microphone, it's actually the shadow. If you look at even – you can see shadows more often because they're more forgiving and they end up in the cut more often. But that happens too.
Well, talk to us about the final cut. That's something that isn't always a director's prerogative, is it, Tom Priestley?
All directors would love to have final cut, but it's just not happening. The studios want you to shoot as much coverage as you possibly can, meaning extra shots, so that once the director hands his edited version of the film to the studio, they can, if they want to, re-edit the film based on what they think the film needs. Now, there's only a few directors I know who have what they call final cut.
Who are those directors?
It would be Steven Spielberg, Robert Zemeckis, people of that nature who, if they wrote on a napkin, a theme for a movie, someone would give them $50 million. But no, most directors do not have final cut. And I mean, I've worked on films that I think one film I worked on was the final. The director's final cut was 2 hours and 40 minutes, and when it was released, it was 2 hours.
Wow!
And the reason for that is you can get more screenings per day with a 2-hour film as opposed to a 2-hour and 40 minute film, and sometimes the product doesn't hold up for 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's a long time for someone to sit in the theater and watch. So I think it was Ragtime that we shot so much. I mean, entire scenes and characters were cut out.
And have you seen that fundamentally change the way a story is told?
Well, today, I don't think they'll give the directors that leeway. They'll keep it very tight, very much the script. Usually a script is 120 pages, somewhere in that nature. And you figure 1 minute per page, which basically translates to 2 hours. And they pretty much stay with that, unless it might be a big spectacular film that warrants all that. But most of the time, it's very close to 2 hours, hour 40 to hour 50, somewhere in there.
You're listening to Coastline. Bull Durham, A Chorus Line, Die Hard with a Vengeance, The Thomas Crown Affair, those are some of the productions my guests today have worked on as critical members of the crew. With us today, Tom Priestley, who's director of photography, and Joe D'Alessandro, camera operator. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also call us today at 910-343-1138. Joe D'Alessandro, what brought you to Wilmington? When did you come here? And why North Carolina for film?
Well, I came in May of 1985. And the particular film that brought me down was Maximum Overdrive, which was directed by Stephen King. And I think... and Jock tells me this story. Jock Brandis, I think, had some part in it, in that on my resume, I listed the few credits I had, which were only two or three at the time. I was just getting started in the business. But I did list that I was fluent in conversational Italian. So I spoke Italian and I was able to communicate. And as you, in our audience probably knows, many of the early, in the early so-called days, that Dino days, much of the department had, most of the departments were brought in from London or Rome.
This so, was when there was a De Laurentiis.
De Laurentiis. This was, yeah, exactly. 83, 84, 85, maybe 6 and 7, I think, when Dino was still. So I think that particular thing, my resume stood out. But I was among many people that were just brought in because there was really no film. They were still building the community. So,
so
was that
you
particular
were brought
film.
In to work on that film, and then you decided to move here?
And then we stayed, yeah.
Why did you stay?
Well, it was an exciting time. It was early in my career. There was a lot of opportunity. It was a great place to be. It was just a great opportunity and an interesting place to live. So,
and was your wife working in the film industry
at
the time?
She was not directly, indirectly. She was involved in, I think at the time she was working in cable access, so kind of in production, but not in narrative, you know, storytelling, narrative, dramatic filmmaking. But she had some production experience.
Ruby from Wilmington called in and asked, how often do actors have trouble reading the script? Tom Priestley.
Generally, I'm not involved in that particular part of the production, but most actors are very conscious of what their character brings to the script and will confer with the director and the writer before we shoot.
And I'm actually going to let you continue your answer when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of film production through the eyes of the crew. Camera operator Joe D'Alessandro and director of photography Tom Priestley are with us today. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Whether a film drops to critical acclaim or scathing reviews depends as much on the people behind the cameras and beyond the directors as it does on the actors and the script. With us to explore not only film production through the eyes of the crew, but also the current state of the business in Wilmington are two longtime film professionals. Tom Priestley has worked on such classic films as The Exorcist, Kramer versus Kramer, Saturday Night Fever, as well as Die Hard with a Vengeance and the Thomas Crown Affair. Joe D'Alessandro is a camera operator and lists among his credits Bull Durham, Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, Nell starring Jodie Foster, Tammy starring Melissa McCarthy, and the TV series One Tree Hill and Dawson's Creek. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also call us today at 910-343-1138. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left for you to get your question or comment in. And Tom Priestley, just before we went to break, you were explaining to Ruby, who'd asked about how often actors have trouble reading the script, what it really is like for an actor dealing with the script.
Most times when an actor accepts a script, they'll be very conscious of their character, and they will confer with the director and the screenwriter.
By the time they show up on the set, it's
already been accomplished. Some directors will allow actors to ad lib a little bit and maybe do the scene the correct way, and then say, "Go ahead, let's try a scene with your input," you know. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But most of the time, it's fairly established before we ever start shooting.
And you have worked on a film where nothing was allowed to be changed when it came to the language or the punctuation. The script was written in stone. What film was that?
That's correct. That was called Network, and Patty Chayefsky was the screenwriter. And you couldn't change a comma or a sentence or anything without his permission. He was on the set every day, and I think they only changed maybe two or three lines in the entire movie. And the director, Sidney Lumet, was very, very conscious of this. But you know, he had so much faith in Paddy Chayefsky, you know, and the famous line, "I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore." It was just a great film. And William Holden, Faye Dunaway, Robert Duvall.
And so that script was the blueprint for the greatness of that film.
In order to make a great film, make a good film, you have to have a good script. I mean, you can have the greatest actors, the greatest cinematographers, production designers. So you've got to have a good script. You have to have content.
Joe D'Alessandro, how often do ad-libs that actors play around with while they're shooting wind up in the final cut of a film? Have you ever been on a set when you've seen them say, hey, let me just try it this way, mm-hmm. and it's completely different from what's in the script or what the director had suggested, but it winds up being genius?
Right. I think where I witnessed that the most was on some of the comedies I worked on, particularly Eastbound and Down and Danny McBride and that whole crew, and then similarly on Tammy. Lisa McCarthy, they both would do the scripted part, and then they were encouraged and allowed to create on the spot. And some of the stuff was really very funny, very brilliant. And I think a lot of it ended up in the movie. Comedy seems to lend itself, maybe in my experience anyway, a little more to that.
Tim from Leland called and asked, what is a gripper? Does he mean grip? What is a grip, Tom Priestley?
Your best friend. No, yeah. Grips are, they do a myriad of work. They operate the camera dollies. They set up flags and nets. They build the platforms. They are the worker bees, and they're greatly appreciated.
Well, help us understand a lot of these roles that we see, you know, in the credits at the end of a film. Best Boy, for instance, Joe D'Alessandro, what is that?
Best Boy is typically the phrase used for the second in command of, let's say, the department head, and usually it's used with the electrical department and the grip department. And one of the kind of ways to describe that is oftentimes the gaffer, who's the head of the electrical lighting department, and the key grip, who's head of the grip department, will say, I'm taking care of today, and the best boy is taking care of tomorrow. So they're kind of, you know, they're still there, they're working with what's happening at the moment, but they're also looking ahead and planning and making sure the right equipment is in the pipeline and that kind of thing. Would you agree, Tom?
Yes, a lot of times the cinematographer loves to have the key grip and the gaffer on the set with him all the time so he can give instructions and ask him what's going on. So the best boys actually do more of the work. They carry out the instructions.
And what is a gaffer?
He's the chief electrician. He helps the cameraman light the set. He provides a lot of the input into the pre-production star side of it by pre-rigging. Certain directors, like Sidney Lumet, whom I work with, would not shoot a movie unless all the sets were pre-rigged, meaning the lights were in place, so that when he comes in, all you have to do is adjust a few things and then you go. He wanted to move very quickly.
Tim also asks, do film crews earn a salary or do they get paid a lump sum before a film or does it come with, how do film crews get paid? And
well,
Joe D'Alessandro.
the crew is typically paid on an hourly basis and these days, particularly in this market, they're usually determined by union contract. So these things are predetermined. And then if you can command it, sometimes people work so-called above scale. But we have contracts we go by, and for different budgeted films, there's different types of contracts.
And so even though North Carolina is a right-to-work state, there are certain folks in the film industry here who are paid union wages.
The majority, I would say. But there's also, I'm sure, a very healthy non-union group as well.
The unions set the standard or the minimum. And then it's up to you as an individual. If you can demand a higher salary, good for you. I mean, but they're there to provide the minimums and for the working conditions.
If someone wanted to get started in film on the crew side, where would they start, Joe D'Alessandro?
I think typically the entry-level jobs are the PA positions and then
production assistant.
Production assistant. That could mean all manner of things. You could work for the assistant director. You could work as a PA in the office. You could be a camera PA. And oftentimes, if budget allows, and there might be a PA in every department. So sometimes those are the easiest access. Tom?
Yes, when I started, we never had PAs. I wish I had PAs when I first started. I did a TV series once where I was the only camera assistant. I didn't even have a second assistant. And so I used to do everything, you know, mark the feet, load the magazines, focus. Everything I had to do was, I was the one-man band, so to speak.
What was that TV series?
It was called The Nurses. It was back in New York in 1963.
Was that during the days of live TV?
No, we filmed it. We filmed it 6 days a week. And we had a director named Herbert Brodkin, and all he wanted was, he wanted a very, very wide master shot and very tight close-ups. That was his kind of format for TV shows.
So if someone wanted to eventually become a director of photography, how long does it typically take to work up from that entry-level production assistant to a DP?
There are so many factors. I came up the standard way. I was a camera assistant for a number of years, camera operator, and became a director of photography. And in those years, you learn so much, and you get so much experience that you can take on any challenge. Now, some people skip a few positions and come up, but most of the time, I would say people are in the business at least 10 years before they become a director of photography.
So it really takes a time
investment. It takes a time, yes. You don't start at the top and work your way down.
Ideally.
Going back to The Exorcist, we talked about how you froze the set and how you got the actors to have visible breath. You also talked about how you were able to levitate Linda Blair, who was a child actor at the time. How did you get her to projectile puke?
They had a very famous makeup artist named Dick Smith, who kind of pioneered these rubber applications that made all the different facial features. What he did was they took a dentist hook scope, they put it in her mouth, and they ran the tube down the side of her face off camera and out underneath her nightgown and out to a pump where they had pea soup. So when she vomited, they just pumped it up and it squirted straight out. But it was really masterfully hidden, and they did a great job at that. It took a long time to set up, too, maybe 3 hours.
Just to set up the pump with the pea soup in it?
Set up everything, her in the bed, you know, everything.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Tom Priestley, who's director of photography, and Joe D'Alessandro, camera operator. Between the two of them, they've worked on such notable films as The Thomas Crown Affair, A Chorus Line, Die Hard with a Vengeance, Bull Durham, Network. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Is there a film that either of you have worked on that you felt didn't really get the reception or the recognition that it deserved based on, you thought, the level of artistry?
Yes, I worked on a film called Wolfen back, I think, 1978, 79. And I thought the look of the film was very innovative and very interesting, and it was a lot of the techniques in the film were just pioneered by the people who participated in it. But for some reason, it just didn't get the notoriety or the press. I don't know why. I mean, I have some reasons. I think that they should never have shown the wolves in the manner they showed them. They should have just kept the mystique of the shadow and just tight shots of the eyes and then this wolf vision. And I think the audience just didn't believe it at the end. And it was a shame because it was a very interesting film.
You also worked on Kramer versus Kramer, which is one of
my favorites.
So why did you like working on that so much?
Well, at the time, I had just become an operator, and I was working with a foreign director of photography, Nestor Almendros, who won the Academy Award. And he worked the European way, which meant that I had a chance to set up all the shots and do everything and unleash my kind of creative instincts. for the first time, and it was just a great treat. Plus, I had worked with Dustin before on Midnight Cowboy, and so we were kind of like friends and stuff. And it was just a very pleasant. Meryl Streep was tremendous. I mean, Bob Benton, the director. I mean, it was one of those films that you just wanted to go to work every day, and you just couldn't wait. You know, it was wonderful.
You worked on Dustin Hoffman, you said, in Midnight Cowboy as well. Tell us about that.
Well, the funny story is he showed up on the set one day, and I looked at him, and I saw his teeth, and it was terrible. And I said, how can they hire an actor with such terrible teeth? And I was young then, and I didn't realize it was a prosthetic that they put to cover his real teeth. And when I found out, I was so embarrassed, but oh, my God, I said, oh, those teeth are terrible.
He also did a lot of ad-libbing in some of those.
Yes, scenes. He was. Dustin's famous for that, you know. And some of the scenes in we call the X flat, which is his dingy apartment and things. And he did. And John Schlesinger, the director, gave him the leeway to do what he wanted. I mean, they do a scene where he performed the scripted words, then they gave him a chance to ad-lib a lot of it, and a lot of it wound up in the movie.
Since Georgia beefed up its film incentive, they've also been expanding their facilities. And we know that so many members of the crew and actors and, you know, people across the industry have migrated to Georgia. Have you seen that among your friends and colleagues, Joe D'Alessandro?
Yes, a number of friends have actually officially moved there and have left Wilmington specifically. So that is a little sad. We need to kind of... Hopefully, this next phase, we'll have to rebuild and hopefully coax some of them back.
You think that will happen? Do you see the rebuilding occurring?
Well, it's just, we're just starting to get work back, so I haven't necessarily seen it specifically, but I think the sentiment is there. I think many these friends that have moved, many of them, I think, would love to come back. As much as they're grateful for the work in Atlanta, I think they'd love to be in a smaller town, smaller market.
And now, Tom, you're retired, but Joe, you're still working. So how are you managing to continue to work?
Well, it's been kind of skinny for me, and I probably should have moved to Atlanta myself, but chose not to. And I'm kind of at the point where I'm going to try to maybe do some other things as well in film and maybe shift gears a little bit. So that's part of why I didn't move to Atlanta.
Okay, I want to ask you about that, but first I want to make sure we get in. This film series at the Cameron Art Museum launches Thursday, March 28th.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a film series, Joe, that is set up to do what?
Well, primarily, the first thing I want to do is increase familiarity and traffic at the Cameron. That's one of the things we want to achieve. We thought a film series would be good for that. There's a lot of film going on in Wilmington, screenings, so we thought the distinction here would be give voice to our filmmakers and our filmmaking heritage. So recognize our past and then hopefully inspire our future.
So Tom Priestley, you will be answering questions about the Thomas Crown Affair. You're going to show that film, and
right.
Then people will be able to ask questions and you'll answer them. What time does that start?
It's going to be at 6:30. Okay. The screening on Thursday, the 28th.
And this first one is free?
This first one is free. There will be more organized sponsorship, and then we're leaning towards a very moderate ticket price.
Okay.
Probably around $5, but we're still working that out.
And then in 30 seconds, how do you want to change the business model for feature-length films?
Well, I personally would love to make more singer-songwriter personal films with 10 people. A different kind of model altogether. Small films.
Small budget.
Small budget, small personal films.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Joe D'Alessandro, Tom Priestley, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Great. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.